The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. In the past year, we've brought you stories about the land, the farms, and the people of Delmarva. Throughout the year, it became clear to us that our listeners want to see the rural character of Delmarva survive. So we began to look deeper into certain questions. What will it take to keep farmers on their land? Is it possible to tend to the health of the environment and also to the needs of the people of our state and our nation? We will explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we can get there together. This week on Soundbites on Delmarva, we'll hear a conversation with Becca Klein, Public Health and Agricultural Policy Project Director, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, about the Farm Bill. A few weeks ago, the Senate passed it, and we spoke with senators from Delaware and Virginia. But the Farm Bill is currently stalled in the House of Representatives, and we'll find out why and what that means for all of us when we talk with Becca Klein. But first, we pay a visit to Mason's Heritage Farm in Queen Anne's County. The Mason family has been farming on the same land since 1890. Now uses most of the farm's 850 acres for growing organic grain, which they sell to organic feed producers. They also have a farm stand where they sell their own produce, including sweet corn and tomatoes, as well as products from other local farmers like meat and dairy. I sat down with Bill and Suzanne Mason at their farm stand to talk about how and why they transitioned from conventional to organic grain farming 6 years ago. What does it mean for a five-generation farm family to switch to organic? And what are the economics of organic farming? And how do they make it? I started by asking Bill about what they were doing before they transitioned to organic.
Well, we were in the custom farming business.
What does that mean?
Well, we had combines. The combine that we use on our farm, we combined crops, harvested crops for other people, hauled them. We planted crops for other people and generated some income that way. But we tilled more land than we did now. We tilled additional farms, did custom work, and then I guess approximately 25 years ago we got in the produce business. We like all farmers, were trying to generate more income, and that was one way that we could generate a little bit more income without renting additional land. We just grew a few acres of vegetables here on this farm and proceeded down that road, and that's turned out to be a pretty nice asset for the farm. We've grown it to be fairly decent in size and incorporate our daughter in it. But
I think, too, that renting ground has become such an ordeal just to find land to rent. And now when Bill and I first got married, you could go out and you could rent acreage for $50 an acre. Now you're looking at sometimes up to $200 an acre. And that's, you know, that's quite a difference. And when you look at years like we're having this year with a drought situation, I mean, that can be a big impact unless you're, you know, sure that you're irrigating your ground and so forth. So, you know, not only is it hard to find land, it's expensive to rent land. So I think it's more important to be more self-sufficient than it is to rely on additional sources for your farm income. So you know, we try to find ways to work with what we have here. So,
well, that's one reason we went to organic farming business, because we found that we could generate more income off the same amount of acres by raising organic crops. So that was the primary reason for us doing that. And, of course, we've stuck with the produce, and we built this building, and the produce business has increased, and the organic farming side has increased. We now have about 550 acres that's certified organic, and we're doing pretty well at that. So,
how big a change is that, just in your kind of own conversations in the family about moving from, you know, renting land and growing and then going to organic? What was that conversation like that y'all had?
Well, I think Bill's father kind of summed it up. We just went back to farming the way we used to. That's interesting. We're stopped using so many chemicals and so many pesticides and herbicides and so forth. And you're basically, that's the way he farmed, 50 years ago. So, I mean, we had reached a point where we did, I guess, so much application, as far as chemicals. And not only, Bill had kind of gotten away from doing that himself, and we actually hired a company to do it for us. But, there again, unfortunately, Bill's mother passed away from cancer 5 years ago. Right. And I think that sort of put, a little bug in our ears that said, maybe we need to do something else. Anyway, so it has proven to be not only financially, a financial stimulus for us, but even if I think we talked because we thought this would be an interesting year to compare conventional and organic farming because of the drought, the price on corn and wheat and soybeans has gone up dramatically. You usually see the price of organic products twice as high as conventional products. But right now, I think conventional prices are so high. Bill and I have said it will be interesting to see what the organic market does this year. If it will,
Well, it's actually just about double now. I just had a call the other day from a guy that...
What is double?
The price of grain that we're selling organically is about double the price of conventional grain because of the drought. The drought really doesn't have anything to do with that. Generally speaking, since we've been in the organic farming business, the price that we receive for grain is about twice as high as the conventional price. You can't grow as much yield, but you can grow anywhere from 2/3 to 3/4 of the yield, but you're getting twice as much for it. So in the end result is you're making a little bit more money per acre, and that's one reason that we're doing it. But the organic farming is, it is a lot different. I would say it's a lot different. We had grown vegetables for, 30 or 40 years prior to that. We had all the necessary equipment. Most farmers in the past few years, including ourselves in the 70s, we switched to no-till. We used more chemicals. We stopped plowing. And I would say farming became easy, but it became easier because you were just basically planting with a corn planter or a no-till planter. You were spraying the ground for all the bugs and worms and fertilizer, and then you were going in there and harvesting it. And you could cover quite a few more acres by yourself. A lot of farmers expanded. They were renting additional ground. The price was going up, but they seemed to be making out fairly well. In our case, we decided to go sort of in the opposite direction, about 6 years ago, and stop using so many chemicals and stop running land. Not that we stopped running land, but we had the necessary equipment from growing vegetables. We had the plows, the cultivators, and things of that nature that you needed to organic farm with. As my wife said, it was like my dad farmed 50 years ago. We plow, we use manure, we use cover crops. And that's the same thing farmers used to do. So we're just sort of going in a big circle, it seems like. But we're a little more efficient than they were 50 years ago. I mean, we have bigger equipment. We can do things faster. We have better seeds. And it's worked out good.
That was Bill Mason of Mason's Heritage Farm. We then talked about what they grew on their 850 acres and who they sell it to.
Corn, soybeans, and barley organically. We actually market them through several sources, Horizon Dairy. Most of our product goes up in Pennsylvania to feed mills that grind organic feed for organic customers. But the market is pretty strong right now. The organic industry has grown up to the last couple years, I think 20% a year. I think even last year they're claiming it grew 11%. I think people are more interested generally in using less chemicals, and if you buy an organic product, it's not supposed to have any chemicals on it. So I think they feel safer and by eating these things.
So I've talked to some other farmers around who raise chickens.
Yes.
Free-range chickens. Both sides. Right. About free-range chickens right now. And they're always saying to me that we can call our chickens free-range. We can call them all kinds of things.
Right.
We can't call them organic because we can't find the feed or the grain
that's
organic to feed our chickens. So that's been a problem.
Right. Well, the supply and demand has been pretty tight in the organic industry the last few years, and the price of organic grain has risen dramatically in the spring. After the fall harvest, usually the price is lower, and people buy a lot of organic grain if they can. But in the spring, when the price rises, it's just too expensive for them to pay the higher price and make a profit. So some of these guys, and I know some in Pennsylvania do that, I sell them some grain that we call transitional, which is when you start to convert a field, you have to go 3 years before you can call it organic. You have to go through the organic process and the steps to have it certified organic. But in the meantime, you're raising the product on that field as organic, and they call that transitional grain. It has no pesticides or fertilizer applied to it. I have several guys in Pennsylvania that are buying that product. They're grinding it into feed. They're raising natural chickens, they call them, or natural turkeys or natural beef, and they're using grain that is pesticide-free. And that's their own little niche. And I think it's growing also. You know, if you want to become certified organic, there's more paperwork involved. You have to fill out, a farm plan every year. We were just inspected the other day. Probably took us about 3 or 4 hours to get inspected. That happens once a year. And you have to have an array of paperwork for them, you know, bills of sale, seeds, things that you sell. And they want, you know, so when they certify you and give you that certificate, they know that you're doing it the proper way. As you know, in the grocery store, just about everything on it says natural anymore.
That's right.
Now,
that can mean
what
anything.
That means, I don't know.
Right.
But you got to put that on there for marketing.
So you use the word niche. One of the conversations you have with farmers who are either raising chickens, like for Purdue
right.
or Tyson or somebody, or grow a lot of soy and corn
right.
to feed that industry,
yes.
will say that part of the argument is that is farming, and that farming, like maybe not yours, but farming like
right.
organic grain farming or farming
the free range
chickens, free range animals, is niche. It's not like something that can really expand and be
yes.
part of it. I mean, how do you, as somebody who's transitioned and whose family's been in farming for 5 generations, and you have friends, I'm sure, throughout the world in farming, I mean, how do you see that, where it is now, where it's going, and those
well,
kind of...
Well, I think it's going to continue to grow. You know, as you said before, I don't know if it's going to feed the world, but it did years ago, but there weren't near as many people. I mean, 50 years ago or 60 years ago, before the advent of chemicals came out in the 1950s, we were feeding the world that way. And everybody seemed to be getting along fine. But as the population grew, some chemical companies and fertilizer companies saw that, you know, they needed to produce more and more, and so they came up with products that would grow more. Now, that's not always the best, you know, I think the natural organic is going to continue to grow. I think people are more concerned now about their food than they've ever been. They're concerned about their kids, especially, what they're eating, what they're putting in their bodies. And I think the population in general is helping us, the organic.
I think organics and natural probably, too, is being sold to a more informed consumer. You know, people that read labels, that pay attention to what they're buying and so forth. And, I mean, I know that's one of the big pushes in our area that the governor has kind of caught on to. It's like, know your farmer. Know where your food is coming from. Know what's being applied to it. And, you know, there again, just be informed about, you know, what you're putting into your body. So, like Bill said, I can only see that as becoming, you know, a larger market, because you will have informed people like this that, you know, want to know what they're doing.
How has that changed your view of farming that has, or your view of this life and just, I mean, making that business decision? Because for you, it wasn't
yeah.
like, you know, I'm going to go join the counterculture and become an
right.
organic farmer. So you made this, you obviously made a business decision, partially a business decision. And
partially life business.
And
yeah.
a life decision to make this leap.
Well, we just thought using less chemicals was better for you. And that was our major goal. And we found out after getting involved in it, we found out we could make a little bit more money doing it. So we knew it was a good move. But
well, it's kind of scary at first, though, I think, because when you decide to go that route, I mean, and you're not growing the crop that you normally grow, even though you are.
Well, we are growing the crop.
But during that transitional period, when you're still getting the price that's a conventional price on what will someday be an organic crop. So you're looking at 3 years of losing income, basically.
Yeah, there is kind of a crunch period there for transition.
You want to make sure you've got to make this work, because if not, I mean, yeah, it could have, you know, kind of severe results, you know, on your bank account.
The thing about organics, most of the time the people call you and want to know what you have for sale, as opposed to taking it to the Purdue or one of the other warehouse places, and you take your truck in there, and whatever they're paying on the board, that's what you get. But when, as in the past few years, with crops being tighter and less of them, we get numerous calls, and they'll say, how much do you have, and how much do you want for it?
We have some negotiating power at this point in
time. We do have negotiating.
Which is something you don't find in farming. So.
No, conventional farmers don't have that.
But and, you don't sell the, I mean, you, Purdue, Tyson, they wouldn't. They don't take your grain.
They do not.
They do not take your grain.
They do not. But we sell, we actually don't sell to, we sell most of our crops now to Mount Air, because they bought a buying station over here. Our conventional crops go to Mount Air. But they're very similar to Purdue. They're a large poultry processor. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, as Suzanne said, there's no negotiation. They put the price on the board that day. That's what you get. But when we got done our corn this year, the corn got tighter. We got done sowing our corn probably in April, and then we started getting calls in May, and the price kept going up. And, of course, we didn't have any to sell. But, you know, the last corn I sold, the guy said, you put your price on it, we'll pay you. It doesn't make any difference what it is. And I was very fair with him. But, you know, the thing is, when you're in the organic livestock industry, to maintain your certificate, you have to feed them organic products. You know, of course, we get some organic magazines, and, you know, they're always talking about the commercial farming aspect and how big these companies are, and especially Monsanto and some of the fertilizer and grain companies are huge. They're multi-billion-dollar corporations, and they're, you know, they're sort of running the grain industry. And even though we're only, I think, maybe 3% of the market or whatever the figure is, it's amazing that the amount of larger companies that are actually trying to get in the organic farming business. They know it's a niche market, and I think they feel as though it's going to continue to grow. But we know several large farm, you know, conventional companies that are in the organic farming business, in the milk industry with Horizon and several other huge companies. They're milking thousands and thousands and thousands of cows and selling organic milk, and I think they're finding out that they can make a good profit doing that. So it's expanding, and of course, you can walk into Walmart now and find organic products, and they're trying to expand, and you know, all the retailers seem to have like an organic aisle now. So it's, I think it's slowly getting there, but I think the writing's on the wall that the larger companies are seeing that it is going to be a good niche market and are trying to get their foot in the door, which the diehard organic people do not like, because they know eventually they're going to take over. You know, organics was brought up on the small-time farmer.
Right.
You know, as you said, the hippie-type guys just said, we're not using any more pesticides, and started growing their own stuff there in the 70s, and it's gotten to where it is today. I think it's a $30 billion industry today. And, you know, these companies, the way they got big is they take note of these small things, and they see a niche, and they're making a profit in it. They're going to get in it, you know.
That's interesting, because one of the things that I was listening to you all talk about, the organic regulations, I mean, historically, a lot of people who come out of farming hate that word regulation.
Yes, that's true.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we're regulated quite a bit. I mean, they know every drop of fertilizer we put on there, every field we plant, how much we harvest. And, you know, I don't like being regulated, but it's part of farming. You know, if you don't like it, you better not get in farming. And it's the same way in a lot of other businesses also. And I know there's groups of farmers that every time something is brought up, they're against it. But it's part of it. And I think if you're doing a good job and doing what you're supposed to be doing, you don't have any problems. But it's for the guys that are trying to work in the gray areas, you know. And that's not only with agriculture, but every other industry also. But, I mean, they're trying to put more regulations on us. Of course, we got the bay here, and it's created a lot of regulations for us as far as runoff and soil management, cover crops, and a host of things. And we fill out reports after reports and send in stuff. And, you know, I'm sure some of it helps. I'm not sure it all helps. But they have a pretty good handle on what everybody's doing, I think. And I don't know if that's always a good thing. You know, you always need a little bit of suspense there on your own part. So you have some sort of a little bit of upper hand on them.
But I think there again, when you're looking at basically agriculture as a food industry, you know, you have to expect a certain amount of regulation.
That's right.
You know, when you're looking at food that's coming in from other countries, you know, how it's being processed and so forth, you know, you need that inspection and you need that regulation.
Well, I think that's where we're falling down a lot.
We are.
You know, the imports of these foods and things. I mean, they're using chemicals in other countries that we banned in the U.S., but we're still importing food and eating it.
Right.
And I don't think that's right. But I do, thinking about ag in the Bay, and I'm sure you might be aware of this, but I just read this the other day. There's more acres of grass in the state of Maryland than there is crops. And I know that they're pushing hard on the urban sector also, you know, as far as the lawn management and things of that nature. So I think everybody's getting a shot of it.
One of the things that, one of the things we talked about a lot, not solely in this conversation, but the whole question of pesticides and chemicals in the Bay. And farmers have been screaming about this for a long time, but people don't look at the acres and acres of chemicals on lawns.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, that and what and the runoff that comes from those.
Yes.
That's huge.
Uh-huh. It is. Well, you figure they're operating on just as many acres as the cropland is.
Right.
And most of them are putting on something.
I mean,
and it's not as regulated as the farming industry is. But I think they're getting more regulations. I know they're working with the phosphorus, taking the phosphorus out of the lawn fertilizer and things of that nature. So, you know, I guess it will come around some point in time.
It will.
I hope so.
So I'm curious how you all see where the future is going with this. I mean, because this is something you made a turn.
Yeah.
It's a personal business decision to, both in terms of what you thought about chemicals and the land and also your own business decision to turn into move towards organic. How do you see, and many people, Wayne Gilchrist, who you all know.
Yes.
Has said to me on occasion, more than once, that he thinks that the Eastern Shore, Delmarva, could become a natural or organic breadbasket for the nation. That's his larger vision of where he sees it going. But so you've been in this business your whole life. You know this land. You know this place. I'm curious what you think of what part this plays in the future, and where do you think it could be going?
Well, I think I don't know where it's going. I know the chicken industry is huge here on Delmarva.
Huge,
and it's a positive for all the grain farmers. That's for sure. Provides a lot of jobs. But there's much concern about the poultry manure issue in the Bay and cleaning up. We do have a great amount of people within a few hours of us. I think there is a market there for organic natural products, you know, from New York to Baltimore to Washington. We certainly have a large group of people that are interested in buying that stuff. And I think it's just going to continue to grow some. That's my opinion. I don't know what Kate thinks. She's going to be running this show.
You will inherit this place, and you're also left the Department of Ag and the bureaucracy and decided to come back home, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I think, like my mom and dad have said, that the organic industry will continue to grow, and even if it's not organic, if it's natural and naturally grown, of course that can be a term, like they've said, that anybody could use and not know what it means. But I think luckily for us, our customer base, and because we've had so many local customers, whether they're from here or DC, coming through, that know us and know our family and know that when we say that something has been naturally grown, if it's in transition for our vegetables, they know that it is in fact naturally grown, that we haven't been using any pesticides, chemicals, etc. on it. So that's actually what's in our high tunnel right now. Everything in there, our tomatoes have been naturally grown and will be certified in October, I guess, sometime this fall, the high tunnel.
Sometime. Sometime. I'm not sure when.
Sometime this fall. So, and
but
we
they're
get...
In the beef, they're in the beef business also.
So my...
You're in the beef business?
We... Well, eventually,
so,
maybe.
Sort
my,
of.
Yeah. My husband grew up on a beef farm in New York, and that's actually where we met, was at Cornell, and his parents have about 300 acres there, about 30 head of cattle that they pasture raise, no added hormones, no added antibiotics, and we've been selling their beef for 3 years now. And this year, we purchased the same amount, number of animals from them that we did last year. And last year, it took us through the fall, and this year, we've already basically sold out of everything. People have gotten word of it and have really enjoyed it. So hopefully, my husband wants to bring some animals down here and raise them. Hopefully maybe one day organically and on organic grain, and we'll have some organic cattle out here, which would be great. We have a lot of people who are interested in that and buying, whether it's quarters, halves, by the piece, by the pound, et cetera. So we're very excited to kind of go down that avenue eventually, hopefully.
Well, I think it's to me, it was one of the reasons I was so excited about coming down to meet y'all. I mean, I knew, never met Kate, but I knew of Kate from the Department of Ag.
Okay.
And it was Elise Chalmers who told us about you all. You know Elise?
Yeah. Oh, Elise. Yes. Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And
is she in the Department of Agriculture?
No. She's CASA.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. And so one of the things we were talking to her about is we wanted to start just meeting people who had actually made transitions. We're trying to build a different kind of business and see how that model worked and how people were. We're doing that.
Okay.
You know.
Well, I guess we're one of them. But we like doing it, and we like trying to maintain our own farm and making a living off that. And I think that's worked out pretty good for us so far.
I think it was interesting because I, when the prices on conventional corn and soybeans started rising this year because of the drought conditions, and I mean, they've reached
all-time highs.
Oh, all-time highs is right. Since I've known Bill and since Bill's been in the farming business. And I told Bill, I said, now it's so much easier to farm conventionally. I said, what if the conventional market surpasses the organic market? What would you do? And he said, I would never stop farming organically at this point. So it becomes a lifestyle. You know, it's not only what you're making, it's who you are. So, and I think we've decided that's where we want to be.
That was Suzanne Mason of Mason's Heritage Farm, along with her husband Bill Mason, in Queen Anne's County. I'm Mark Steiner, your host for Soundbites on Delmarva. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll be joined by Becca Klein, the Public Health and Agricultural Policy Project Director for the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, to talk about the Farm Bill and why it stalled in Congress and what it means for all of us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. We spoke with Rebecca Klein, Director of the Public Health and Agricultural Policy Project at the Center for Livable Future at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, about the Farm Bill and why it stalled in Congress and what it means for all of us. We're in the midst of this Farm Bill. Every 5 years it pops up in Congress. It's a huge bill.
Huge.
Huge. Probably one of the single biggest bills after defense that Congress has to wrestle with.
It's extremely large, and depending on whether we're looking at the draft that the Senate has written or the draft that the House Agriculture Committee has written, the numbers are different. So the numbers of pages and the numbers of dollars. So the Senate bill draft is about 1,000 pages long, whereas the House bill is 600 and something pages long. So that kind of just gives you a quick visual into how much the House has sort of cut from what the farm programs are that are available through the Farm Bill.
I started by asking Rebecca to give us the history of where the Farm Bill came from, because many of us have no idea of its origins or its consequences.
So the Farm Bill
is what they call an omnibus piece of legislation, which means it has a lot of different pieces put together. And so it covers the food stamp program, formerly known as food stamps, now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Exactly. Much easier to say SNAP. And then there is conservation programs. There are commodity support programs. So much of this involves dollars to help farmers when prices are low for things like corn and wheat and soy and cotton. There are also some of those programs that just directly pay farmers based on their historic production in order to help them sort of stay afloat, because we like to talk about in the agriculture community, it's not like a regular factory where if the prices change or demand changes, you can almost immediately shift what you're doing in a factory setting. Whereas if stuff is already planted in the ground, it's not as if farmers can suddenly do something else. It's a very different sort of product. And so we do need these government supports in order to ensure that farmers have some sort of protection as they move forward throughout the year in terms of weather disruptions or price changes.
Our way of farming and the agricultural system has changed drastically since the 1930s, when the Farm Bill was first introduced. So I asked Rebecca if the progression toward a more industrialized agricultural system played any role in defining today's Farm Bill.
I would say it's both and. I would say the bill has changed as the system has changed, and what's in the bill has influenced how the system changed.
Okay.
So the bill also covers research. And so a lot of what the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, does is design research in order to help farmers who are growing certain crops. And it sort of happened over the years that it began to be those commodity crops that got the most support. So we just mentioned those, that a lot of corn, wheat, soy, cotton. It allows the price to go down. It allows the farmers to be more productive. Machinery has been adapted. Pesticides have been adapted. There's even genetic changes that some people may support, some people may not, that have changed such that production has increased in these areas. And some people are saying, well, hey, why don't we also invest even more in research that starts to build the food system that those of us in the health community are advocating for, or those in the organic agriculture community, so that the balance even in the research has been off.
There's always a lot of battle around this bill.
Yes.
A lot of this bill in this time was done, some argued, in too much secret behind closed doors in the beginning of this particular bill for this year.
Yes. So the bill started out being negotiated during the sequestration process, which some people may remember, that whole thing of we have to figure out how we're going to cut the deficit or everything's going to stop. And so they started negotiating the Farm Bill between the Senate and the Agriculture Committees at that point, because they thought, hey, if we get this settled now, we won't have to worry about it come the actual time to renew the Farm Bill. We would have taken care of it already. And there were some people who said, oh, well, those negotiations are actually better because the chairwoman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Debbie Stabenow, has done a lot for fruits and vegetables and for some of the farmers market programs and things that people are trying to push for in terms of change in the system. And so some people thought, oh, well, she's the most in power, and so it's okay that it's behind closed doors because she is a strong leader for the things that we want. On the other hand, it's a really bad precedent to set in terms of allowing some piece of legislation to be determined behind closed doors in such a way. As we all know, that super committee process failed, so that secret bill didn't go anywhere, although it did sort of begin to lay the groundwork for what was then negotiated moving forward. And then still, what did happen in both the Senate and the House Agriculture Committee side of things is that the whole process was very fast. So while it was more public, it was still very quick, and there was not much of an opportunity for outside groups, those not with their toes and fingers inside the Beltway already, to really have their say. It takes time to become educated about what's going on, to figure out the nuances. You know, if the bill is somewhere between 600 to 1,000 pages long and you're trying to keep track of it all, you need time.
And that's not. And time was not given.
Time was not given.
That was Rebecca Klein, Director of the Public Health and Agricultural Policy Project at the Center for a Livable Future. We're about to explore the two main components of the Farm Bill. Farming is not the biggest part of the bill, however. SNAP is. That's a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, as it was formerly known. Most of the rest of the Farm Bill is insurance and subsidies for farmers who grow things like corn, soy, cotton, and wheat in our country. I asked Rebecca how these two components have changed over time in our farm bill and about what's inside of each of them.
That is the largest part of the bill and potentially growing. So it was that the food stamp program was the largest, and then the commodity program was, which is what you mentioned. And now I think, believe it was conservation after that, and then what they call the risk management programs, which is the insurance, crop insurance, and that sort of thing that you mentioned. And so what's happening now is a lot of people, both from the left and the right, fiscal conservatives, as well as those who want to see a shift in the system, are saying these commodity programs that we have aren't appropriate, and so let's change them. And so there's, some people may have heard the term direct payments bandied around, which means payments going to farmers based on the historical production of their land. So that land might not even be producing right now, or it might be producing, but it's just a big complicated trade issue that came up. So the government created this program to do direct payments so that they weren't specifically supporting a crop that a farmer was growing, so that they wouldn't be going against a trade agreement that they had set up, hence the birth of direct payments. But people are saying, okay, wait, no, that's not right either. We should only be supporting farmers who are growing things. And so now what they're saying is risk management is the way to go. Let's increase what we're doing with the crop insurance program and spend less money on the commodity support programs in terms of payments toward crops being grown. That's still going to happen to some degree, but more and more emphasis is going to go into this crop insurance. So a few things are going to change. The one that we are the most concerned about at the Center for a Livable Future is this issue called conservation compliance, which basically means that people who had been getting these commodity supports, the direct payments, were required to do a minimal amount of conservation on their land. Like, the crop insurance subsidy program does not have that conservation compliance tied to it. They get some subsidies paying for the premiums for their insurance program. However, they're not required to do this conservation compliance if they get that financial help. And so what we are saying, conservation groups are saying, the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, many, many groups are saying, hey, let's just make this basic common sense link again, this basic social contract.
Was it made in the Senate bill?
It was made in the Senate bill.
It was not made
in the House bill.
Which has gone nowhere right now.
Neither bill is going anywhere right now.
So that doesn't go through. I mean, that means you'd have the crop insurance money, you'd have money to back up if there was a failure across the country, but they wouldn't be required to have buffers. They wouldn't be required. What does that mean?
It's very minimal things like buffers. It could be a cover crop planting. It just depends on what the farmer works out with USDA per thing. So it means, one of the things it means is that they can plant anywhere on their land. They can plant on what the USDA calls highly erodible land, so land where the soil could just blow away really easily, wash away really easily.
As we're watching all throughout the Midwest right now.
Exactly. And so it also means they could plant wetlands, so dry out and dig up wetlands, which are habitat for various animals and very important for biodiversity. We are also concerned because, you know, most, on an individual level, a farmer is going to be a reasonable person. She's going to make good decisions about what's best for her farm. But what's best for her farm or her income might not be best for the entire country as a whole, which is why we need the government involvement in certain ways. And so she may choose not to take these basic conservation measures. She may say, you know what, look, the prices of corn are really high right now. I have this huge loan for this huge tractor that I bought. I need to plant more so that I can pay this off. So I'm going to plant everywhere, even though that land's not the best. I have insurance now, so if something bad happens, at least I'm insured. And so one of the concerns is that the insurance could almost act, even if it's sort of subconscious, as a incentive for farmers to plant these more vulnerable lands. And so we just want from the beginning to say, hey, you know, we'll help you pay the subsidies, and we will help you pay the premiums with these subsidies if you just do this basic conservation. We ensure these most vulnerable lands are protected.
In the past, we've talked with our state legislatures about the Farm Bill, our U.S. senators, farmers, in part exploring what the bill does for small farmers, organic farmers, and sustainable farmers. I asked Rebecca to explain what the House of Representatives wants to cut from the Senate bill and whether we're going to have a farm bill at all.
So, and just to clarify, the Senate, the full Senate, passed their bill, whereas in the House, it only got as far as passing through the House Agriculture Committee. So it was still waiting to go to the House floor to be passed. but they haven't even fully passed it in the House yet. So there could be a chance to add some things back in if the House leadership would bring it to the House floor, which a lot of people were pushing for, but they didn't believe that they had the votes to get it through, and so they didn't bring it in. This is where the election politics begin to get involved. The Senate bill did have some great things, little things like allowing the SNAP benefits, the food stamp benefits, to be used for CSAs, community-supported agriculture, some pilot programs to test the use of mobile technology for accepting those electronic SNAP cards, the EBT cards.
Mm-hmm.
The addition to the Farmers Market Promotion Program, I believe it's now the Farmers Market and Local Foods Promotion Program, which now will allow not only funds to go toward helping the markets have better advertisement, helping the structure of the markets, but also can be used towards the creation of food hubs, those aggregation points that allow smaller farmers to sell to big grocery stores, to sell to restaurants in the city, so that there doesn't have to be a one-to-one relationship between the farmer and each of these businesses, but instead the farmer can sell toward the food hub, and then the food hub makes sure that food gets delivered throughout wherever it needs to go.
This was an article in the New York Times about how the outer aisles of the supermarket are actually growing in terms of their importance and place when they used to be kind of peripheral,
right,
where all that fresh food was, and
right,
meat and dairy, and the aisles full of canned foods and boxed foods are actually losing money as opposed to the other aisles, which are now gaining money, which I find interesting.
That is interesting. That means those communication efforts by various health professionals are working out. I know that both Marion Nessel and Michael Pollan have spoken a lot about that placement of things in the grocery store.
Exactly.
And it sort of got that way for practical reasons, in terms of those were the foods that needed to be kept cold because they were alive. And if you think about,
right,
eating something that's alive, likely, you know, you're alive. Maybe you want to continue to be alive by eating something that's alive. So they needed to be near the outlets and the plugs to stay cold. And then the stuff that could sit on the shelves can be in the interior,
exactly,
of the store. There were some great beginnings around organic agriculture in the Senate bill. There was the organic cost share program, which basically helps farmers pay the fees that it takes to convert to an actual registered organic operation, because that can cost a lot of money. That can be a barrier. You know, if you go speak to your farmer, a couple favorite farmers at the farmer's market, some of them may say to you, hey, I use organic methods. My methods are maybe even more organic, more sustainable than what the USDA's organic program allots for, but I just can't afford to be part of that program.
That would be a discussion for an entire program almost by itself.
Right.
But what we call organic, because so many farmers who want to be part of this bill so they can grow their business will not call themselves organic. They say, we farm naturally, we use some organic principles, but we can't go through that program. It's too expensive. It's too onerous.
Right.
Whether they're organic farmers, sustainable farmers, or large-scale soy corn farmers on old farms around the country, around the Eastern Shore and around the country, they all kind of are tired of the government telling them what to do.
Right. It's true, which is,
it's, in a way,
right? It's that's why I think, and others have said, we need to work on building up the demand side of this whole structure, because farmers are innovative, farmers are creative, farmers work hard, and so they will grow what people want.
They are not the enemy.
They're not the enemy at all.
That's part of the problem. I think sometimes people involved in want to transform a food system and want to transform this ag bill, which needs transformation, often kind of the farmer up as the enemy when,
yeah,
these are people who have been on that land, some of them for 200, 300, 400 years. It's who they are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just to even an example kind of relevant to Maryland of that is the 2008 Farm Bill. So the last time there was a Farm Bill, there were some measures put in place to make contracts for livestock and poultry growers to be more fair, because basically it's the integrators, they call it, or the processors, the people who are taking the animals, slaughtering them, packaging them, who have the power. And so there were some basic, simple things put in place to make the contracts that exist between these integrators and the growers more fair for the growers. Over the past 5 years since the passage of that bill, there have been these huge fights to get the rules protected, to get the rules implemented. Some people have been trying to scale the rules back. And so what's happened in the House Agriculture Committee version of the bill is that most of those rules are being stripped away. And so that is not fair, especially, you know, our Eastern Shore poultry growers.
What are the key elements right now? And actually, you know, you find a lot of farmers, a lot of organic farmers. Well, I found a lot of small farmers across the state who would say, we don't want any ag bill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just leave us alone.
Right.
Like that.
We need the food stamp program attached to the farm bill so that their urban interests, urban legislators, and the more rural legislators continue to have some things that they both really care about that are in the bill. Obviously, there's a lot of crossover. However, that's kind of a main sticking point for this. And then in terms of whether or not to have a bill at all, I think there really are some important aspects to having some support from the government around agriculture, especially as climate change increases and we begin to have more extreme weather events. There could be some real needs for some support. And I think the problem is that it's been targeted to too few types of growers as versus sort of the whole span of who's out there. And mm-hmm. if we really did have programs that ran the gamut, you know, the USDA talks about how it's out there for all farmers, all kinds of producers. But if you look at sort of the allocation of funds, for example, this farmers market promotion program is in the millions, whereas the crop insurance programs are in the billions. And both bills have something this time around called whole farm revenue insurance, which is a great thing where it's an insurance program designed for diversified farms. So if you think about it, if I asked you to insure everything that I do and I own, you'd have to ask me a lot of questions, right?
Right.
You'd have to put together a really complicated insurance product. Or if I just said, hey, will you insure my bicycle? Like, that makes a lot more sense. And not to compare corn growing to bicycle, it's not the same thing, but it's sort of, you think, oh, corn generally has one price, average. It's kind of easy to get a sense of how much corn should be grown on how much land, what a farmer should be producing. And then if they have a problem, you can figure out, okay, well, here's how I can compensate you for the problem that you had. Whereas if you're growing 50 different crops, you might have animals on the farm, you might not. It's more complicated.
What do you see as the critical issues now between
right.
this House and Senate? They need to pass it before the end of session.
They need to pass something by September 30th. Because that's when the current five-year legislation
is done.
That's when we revert back to 1949.
And what would it mean if we reverted back? What would it mean if we reverted back to 1949?
You know, honestly, I haven't read the 1949 bill, but if you think about what agriculture was like at the end of World War II as versus now, it's a very different system. There are many fewer farmers on the land. They're growing in entirely different ways. The food stamp program was not part of the bill at that point. There was no conservation program as we know it today. So they're just...
Companies in Maryland, Purdue and Tyson, and people growing lots of chickens were just beginning in 1949.
Right.
There wasn't like... This was a huge piece of agriculture. Farms on the Eastern Shore were dairy farms, and they were truck farms, and they were vegetable farms, and...
Yeah.
It was a very different place.
It was a very different
there were
place.
Slaughterhouses on the Eastern Shore, places to put to stock their food and sell it out.
Right.
That whole infrastructure is gone.
Exactly. I think that something is going to pass. Likely it's going to be a one-year extension of the bill.
Of the old bill.
Of the 2008 bill, as they call it, yes.
So you think that's what may happen?
That has the highest chance of happening.
Because in the election year they may not come to it because everybody wants the White House.
Exactly. What I really wanted to mention in terms of what you were saying with what needs to shift between the two, one of the major things is the food stamp program itself. SNAP is cut by about $4.5 billion, or the whole nutrition title itself, all of the anti-hunger programs in the Farm Bill are cut by about $4.5 billion in the Senate version and $16.1 billion in the House. So that's a huge difference. Well, they both end the direct payments. The conservation compliance issue that we mentioned is different in the Senate and the House bill. So we had said the Senate is saying, yes, let's tie these basic conservation measures to the help we're giving you to get your crop insurance. The House doesn't do that. There's another conservation measure that the Senate put in that they call sod saver, where if you think of native sod. It's basically native ground that's never been turned into farmland before. Mm-hmm. So it's really valuable, healthy land, good for kind of perennial growth of things, grasslands and that sort of thing. Also can be very sensitive land. And so the Senate says that if you bust up the sod busting, that they're not going to give as much help to buy the crop insurance. Whereas the House says, yeah, we kind of agree with that, but we're only going to put that program up in the mid, what they call the prairie pothole region of the Midwest. So instead of applying it nationally. So you can start to see a little bit of sort of limiting the ability of the USDA to encourage farmers to do these basic conservation measures. There are a couple other things that were sort of slipped into the House version of the bill. There was some things around genetically engineered food and crops where the House basically put in some measures that would limit the USDA's ability to regulate as much and to have as many sort of hoops that one would have to jump through to prove that these crops were safe for human and environmental health before they were allowed to be planted. They're sort of trying to, as you know, with the House having the political climate that it does, there's a lot of interest in minimizing regulation. But the basic thing to know is that both bills cut conservation. The House bill cuts it a little more severely than the Senate bill does. And so in a lot of ways, groups are saying, do this X, Y, and Z from the Senate bill and keep this one or two good things from the House bill, because there are some things on the House side that people are supportive of.
And you do think that, public input is important in this. This is
I do. I know. I used to think, whatever. You know, it seemed to me that when I first started this work, you know, that Congress was a thing and the USDA was a thing and the administration was a thing. But then the more I got into it, it's all people. And those people, the ones who have the decision-making power, they want to be reelected. And so their constituents have a huge amount of power in terms of getting things done. And so our democracy, unfortunately, doesn't work as well as it might because there's a lot of money influencing things. But if people really did know the power of their own voice, I think we would see a lot more changes toward what those voices were saying, if those voices would speak. So I wanted to mention a couple of resources that your listeners might find interesting. The Center for Livable Future has created what we call the Farm Bill Budget Visualizer, which takes the dollar-for-dollar amounts of all of the Farm Bill programs and puts them into different size boxes so that you can see, for example, how tiny the Farmers Market Promotion Program is in comparison to the Commodity Support Program. And you can just begin to get a visual sense of what the Farm Bill is at all. So that's at www.jhu.edu/farmbillvisualizer. And then another resource for those who are really interested in what's going on in Maryland is we have the Maryland Food System Map. Mm-hmm. And that is a great tool to see not only the kinds of farms that are out there, but also where their food access points, health factors, income factors. And so you begin to get a whole picture of all of the facets of the food system in Maryland. And that's available at mdfoodsystemmap.org.
That was our conversation with Rebecca Klein, Director of the Public Health and Agricultural Policy Project at the Center for a Livable Future at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. We were also joined by Bill and Suzanne Mason of Mason's Heritage Farm in Queen Anne's County for a conversation about organic grain farming. I want to thank all of our guests, Rebecca Klein, Bill, and Suzanne Mason, for joining us. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.